Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Right, it's Thursday, 1 o'clock, and you are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to The Farm Report. This is Aaron Fairbanks coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we are on the line today with Dee Dee Emmons. Dee Dee, welcome to the show.
Hi, Aaron.
So great to have you. So you are quite the Renaissance woman. We have you on the show today to talk about your newest cookbook, Wild Flavors, One Chef's Transformative Year Cooking from Eva's Farm. But your work spans far beyond cookbooks, and I wonder if you could maybe give us a brief recap. I mean, looking at your work, it seems like you span the intersections of cooking, health, farming, pleasure, conservation, social justice. I mean, can you give us a little bio wrap-up so we can kick off the show?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good thing is I think you're going to talk to Eva after this, the woman I wrote the book about, and you know, I think of her as the Renaissance, quintessential Renaissance woman. But it depends, I guess, what you think of as a Renaissance person. But I live in the city. I live in Boston and, went to college in New York City, but I'm now 48 and, right now I'm juggling a lot of different things, but I started a nonprofit in, Roxbury, kind of a poor section of Boston. We opened a restaurant called the Haley House, and I was the founding chef. And our goal was to try to provide an environment where people could commune and eat healthy, affordable food. And it started like very, very slowly, and people trickled in. And now, 6 years later, it's bustling. It's cranking, and I'm teaching inner city youth there now. I have a program called Take Back the Kitchen. I also consult with the Boston Public Schools. I work with Project Bread, a big nonprofit here. I'm writing a cookbook for public school cafeterias, and also working as a chef in the schools. So that's a little bit of what I'm doing besides writing. I love kids. I really, and I am a good cook. So those two have fused into these, you know, into this kind of new arena that I never expected. So
that's great. I feel like that's like so often the story of people who get engaged in food is kind of one stone uncovers something new, and you can kind of just keep digging further and further in. And what I loved about Wild Flavors is you use some stuff in there that you don't see often in cookbooks. Arugula sativa, I will say, as the Latin name for arugula. One of the things I loved about the book was you really incorporated some information on kind of the plants and the plant's history. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the decision to lay the book out like that. And what do you think that you bring to the table by choosing to include something like that?
Well, I think that I have spent 10 years down at Eva's Farm, and from a culinary point of view, which is kind of like my main, you know, goggles, my main point of view, I see these plants growing there. She grows over 200 herbs and greens, and so I see the world, you know, from these herbs and greens. Many of them I've never tried, you know, like lovage or calamint, or some of them I've tried many times, but they tasted nothing like the kind, like rhubarb or arugula or sorrel and chervil, because these herbs are so fresh, they're so organic, you know, the soil is so nutrient dense, that I fell in love all over again with many plants, but also encountered many new ones. So I divided the book up by 46 plants. My 46 are my very favorite. And it really talks about how to use the plant as a whole, like not just at one stage in its life cycle, like arugula, you know, what you can do with arugula flowers, or what you can do with bolted arugula, or what you can do with baby arugula. And then there's wild arugula. You know, there's a bunch of wild arugulas, but she grows Silvetta, which is a really, like, killer baby arugula that is so worth growing. I don't know why we just don't, you know, stick with that. But anyway, she's just endless in the kinds of plants that she grows and the stages that she stops the plant and enjoys it and sometimes lets it continue to grow.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about your work together is this real focus on conservation, on using food at all of its stages and using all of its pieces. And, you know, I know from working in fine dining, that can often be challenging. And what do you think, I mean, is the chef's responsibility to using it all? And where do you think that kind of tradition has gotten lost in today's kitchens?
Well, I mean, fortunately, I think it's celebrating a resurge. I think that many chefs now are you know embarrassed if they don't compost, or they if they haven't figured out what to do with their leftovers. I think it's getting to the point where it's very unfashionable to not be aware of sustainability. And also, I think Eva has done a great service by offering them, first of all, advice on how to how to use the plant many different ways, so they're not wasting any of the plant, but also introducing them to these new stages, cilantro. She'll use the cilantro berries and the cilantro flowers, and she'll sell those. And so the chefs have become, the chefs that have worked with her, and there's some in New York and there's some in Boston, they become aware of, you know, maximizing the plant. And through them, all of their diners do, too. So it's this really, really great trickle down. And I think the book is just, you know, I wanted to write it to kind of speed things along, you know,
yeah,
so that people became more aware of, the benefits of growing, mainly, and but the delight of even buying local food from farmers markets. And so that's what it's about. It's about the plants and celebrating them.
So one of the things I find so interesting about working with farmers or buying locally is, you know, you get to develop this relationship with the person that you're purchasing food from. If you're a chef, and like you were able to go onto Eva's farm and really learn a lot from her. But I think there's also kind of this corollary learning that happens from the other side. And I'm curious what you think are the lessons that maybe you've taught Eva, because I know the relationship has probably gone both ways.
Oh, that's like funny, because I don't think of, you know, of me teaching her anything. I mean, she's 20 years older than me. I mean, that might be a good question for her. I think that I might be able to help her out sometimes with certainly with ideas for plants. I sometimes come up with ways to cook with these plants or work with them that she hadn't thought of before, because we're both really scrappy and we're creative. And she, you know, went to art school, and I went to NYU, but I was pretty out there. And so that's one. And two, you know, I don't know, just, you know, bringing friends down that she had never met before. I mean, she just delights in people. She loves meeting new people, and you know, maybe also I don't know, it's a question for her, really. I think the friendship has been a good thing in her life, but she has more friends than anybody I know, so and she has a special way of making you feel like you are the most special, which is really a gift. It's really a wonderful thing to feel.
Yeah, well, I look forward to it. We're bringing her on in the second half of the show, and I will definitely ask her. I always just find it interesting,
yeah,
like, because learning and relationships go both ways. I'm curious, you know, you you working with her and working on a farm that produces these kind of really special products, and how do you find like that is different in your restaurant, in particular looking at the work you do with inner city youth? Do you find that kids are more resistant or less resistant, or does it not really matter?
Well,
or
yeah, good question. I mean, and just to go back, I think one thing that also that Eva really appreciates is that I'm just a huge fan of her herbs and her, I think, what she grows, and you know, by cooking with them and being really enthralled with them, I think that spurs her on to, you know, continue, and it's a hard job that she has. But as far as the inner city kids that I teach, it's funny, when I bring herbs of the like most strangest kind, and you know, they come with, you know, complete with caterpillars and, you know, other insects, other kinds of animals, and when I bring those herbs to the classes, those are the classes that are the most successful. Those are, you know, the big thing I do is really trying to push open their range. I try to open up their range of what they're willing to eat, and that I think is like the big problem right now, is that a lot of kids have very small range, and they aren't eating as healthfully as they could be. So because they've just been like severed from the earth, these plants that I bring, these herbs, like let's just say purple basil and dill and lemongrass, you know, for example, I'll bring them to the table and we'll smell them and taste them, and the sugars are really running high. You know, we've just cut the plant, and the nutrients, all the chemical compounds, everything is just exploding, and that's what our whole farm is about. It's about flavors, and the kids get really, it's like they're eating candy, or they're eating a new candy. They're so kind of excited by it. And even if it's just a vegetable, if I bring zucchini from the farm, they're so intrigued. They're so curious, you know. They're like cats. They just, you know, if I bring a zucchini with the zucchini flower, they're fascinated. So, you know, it's just wonderful. You would think that a lot of them would be, you know, they're not allowed to actually use words that are negative. You know, they're not allowed to use the word nasty or disgusting, or, but it doesn't matter. Even still, the classes that I have with the fresh farm produce are like twice as good as the classes that, and I try to have a lot of classes that are, you know, that utilize supermarket ingredients, you know, regular old you know, boxed, you know, pasta and
right,
whatever
stuff that
it is,
people have
onions
access to
in the bag. So I try to utilize food that they can get on their hands, but I just can't believe the, you know, the different reaction I get with farm fresh, you know, food.
Yeah, I think that can be fun sometimes. It's almost on one level, it's almost like the wackier the better, because what you're looking to do is kind of incite interest. And speaking of health, I mean, what do you feel like as a professional chef, what is a chef's responsibility for ensuring that their food is healthy? And I mean, how do you kind of balance the health of your dishes with the, you know, the taste and the pleasure, kind of looking between the two?
Well, I've always been the kind of chef, not always, but the four restaurants I've started have always been affordable restaurants. So I probably think more differently than most trained chefs. But what's important is that the food is healthy, and, you know, it doesn't need to be farm fresh, because it can't be for me, from you know, sustaining the business from an economical standpoint. So the pizzeria that we ran that was vegetarian in Harvard Square, you know, we barely ever got produce from a small farm. We couldn't afford that. But the food was really healthy if you compare it to, you know, haute cuisine that has a lot of fat in it, you know, cream sauces and not high in vegetables. I mean, this was a vegetarian restaurant. But now working in the nonprofit restaurant, it's even harder, because people, a lot of people aren't accustomed to a lot of vegetables. They want a lot of meat in the neighborhood that we're working in. And all I can say is that it's changing, and that there are a lot of, it's tough. The whole working with small farms. I think that we try to do it as much as we can, and it's a whole lot more than I did in my for-profit business before this one. So the nonprofit is able to, I think they feel a bigger allegiance to working with small farms, being connected to their food. So I guess that's, you know, there's businesses have, you know, bottom lines, and they have to work with that. And
absolutely.
I think the best thing to do is to try to keep meat as a very, you know, small part of the meal. That's the one of the best ways I know to keep costs low and keep food healthy.
Awesome. Dee, thanks so much for coming on. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll bring Eva on. But before we do, I just wondered, is that if you had to pick one recipe from the book that we should be sure to check out, I'm sure you get asked this question all the time, where would you direct us?
Well, I'm looking at the book. I mean, I'm looking at green eggs and no ham and ham. There's a recipe that infuses all these herbs in the blender with raw eggs, and then after that you scramble them, and it's great with toast and goat cheese. It's just terrific. So I'll give you that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on a beautiful book, and we look forward to having you on the show again sometime soon.
Thanks so much, Erin.
Love to tell their stories. Hot Bread Kitchen is a non-profit, multi-ethnic bakery and job training program out of Manhattan, whose range of international breads are as impressive as they are authentic. Learn more at hotbreadkitchen.org or visit one of our 6 Manhattan locations for a taste.
All right, we are back. You are tuned into the Farm Report, and we are on the line with Eva Somaripa. Eva, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Did I kill your last name?
No, you did it exactly right. You have to think Summer Reaper.
So we just wrapped up with Dee Dee talking about the cookbook Wild Flavors, One Chef's Transformative Year Cooking from Eva's Garden, and that's you. So can you tell us a little bit about the garden and kind of how you got started and what you guys grow?
Okay. I got started with it just as a home garden. I had a neighbor who was a French-Canadian lady who raised goats and milked them. And she had a lot of herbs because she thought that herb pasture was good for the goats and the milk.
Yeah.
And she gave me plants, and I started planting them. And it just grew from there.
So you didn't come from a farming background. You studied pottery. Is that correct?
I did. Yep. But I had my parents always had a garden, a backyard garden, and other relatives had even bigger gardens, and I was always drawn to those gardens.
And so today, what does the garden is the name, but But I mean, can you give us a sense of scale? How big are you guys, and what type of how are you selling? Do you do farmers markets, or is it all into restaurants? And what are some of like your key crops?
It's probably one of the smallest commercial farms in Massachusetts. It's, I would say, maximum 3 acres cultivated, maybe more like 2.5 when you subtract the buildings. And that's one of the reasons that I grow a lot of herbs, because that you can still, you know, there's more value per square foot in herbs than, say, pumpkins, for which you need acres and acres. Although I do grow a few pumpkins, too. I grow a little of everything that we like to eat, and then other things, many things for sale. And I mostly sell to restaurants and to Whole Foods and to a few distributors.
Wonderful.
Send it to other restaurants.
Send it around. How did you get, I think that's one of the things often the farmers we bring on the show are curious, you know, how do they break into the restaurant market? I mean, how did that start for you? Were you showing up at the back door of kitchens with, you know, a tray of lovage, trying to explain what it was? Or how did people find you, or did you find them?
In the early days, I had mostly standard herbs, rosemary, thyme, sage, parsley. And I lived in Cambridge part-time and out in the on the farm part-time. And I would. It was a weekly commute most of the season, and except in summer, I was out at the farm more. And at that time, which was in the early 70s, it was very hard to get fresh herbs in the city. So I lived in Cambridge, Mass, near Whole Foods at that time, Bread and Circus, and I just brought, I had more rosemary than I could possibly use, and so I brought some in, see if they wanted it, and they did, and they bought it, and slowly word got out to a few chefs, and I would just pay for my gas on the commute by just bringing in herbs, and then it got more and more, more herbs, more customers. It just kind of evolved.
I had asked Dee Dee this question in the earlier part of the show, but I'm curious how your choices as a farmer were impacted by the chefs you work with, and you know, when you're looking at varieties or you know, what you're going to grow or when you're going to harvest it. I mean, how much is that a back and forth between you and the restaurants that you've worked with? I mean, do you think you're influencing them or they're influencing you? I'm sure it's somewhere in the middle, but how has that kind of worked for you?
Well, one of the greatest pleasures is that it's totally both ways. And I love getting ideas from them. I love being asked, do you have something that maybe I've never even heard of before? And I look it up, and then I start looking where you can get the seed, or I tell them something that they've never heard of before. It's fun. It's a very mutual exploration. And I will often ask, well, so what are you going to do with it, when they ask for a pound of something? And because I'll pick it differently, or from a different age plant or a different part of the plant, if they're doing one thing versus if they're doing another thing. So if they're just chopping up, doesn't matter if it has some holes in it. And if it, you know, if it's going to be featured as a leaf on a plate, then I have to make sure that they get very perfect leaves or flowers or whatever it is. I do a lot of edible flowers, too, by the way, which I consider just part of the plant that you eat, but they're also pretty.
Yeah, I've read in, can you tell us a little bit about your idea for naked salads?
Well, I grow many, many different kinds of greens. The mixes that I sell are different every week. Never would you get exactly the same combination 2 weeks in a row. So, I try to combine hot flavors and slightly bitter flavors, sour flavors, sweet flavors. And when you grow the whole gamut of possible greens, you have a huge gamut of flavors, and sometimes we'll put in a few tender herb leaves in there. We have what we call the wild mix, which has more of the unusual things, and then the combo mix, which is combination, which gives me permission to put a lot of great variety of things in that some people might not even consider plants. So, I mean, I have weeds, but in my soil, some of those weeds are really delicious, and they're often considered forage things, and I suppose to some extent they are, but they're also kind of half-cultivated because they're in really good soil. And like chickweed, for example, and purslane, things like that,
yeah,
that are normally just resented are, I mean, wow, the purslane is up. And it's usually beautiful and tasty, and we've introduced it to a lot of people. So anyway, back to your question, there are a tremendous variety of flavors, colors, and textures. And I feel that when you put a dressing on a salad, you often, when you have those varieties, you will often lose the pleasure of the variety. And sometimes if it's, I mean, some dressings are wonderful, and if it's on a fairly bland or mono greens group, you know, that maybe has just a couple things, or if the actual flavor and other qualities of the plant, of the leaf, are not so important, then it's great to have a dressing. Then the leaf becomes a vehicle for holding the dressing. Whereas I think sometimes, not always, I mean, I'm not stuck on that, but I think lots of times the combination is of the greens is so special and so wonderful that you should do whatever you can to feature it and not hide it behind anything else.
Yeah, no, that's it's essentially like an elevation of the green to the centerpiece as opposed to like a background note to other things.
And one of my favorite things to do with ways to serve the beautiful greens is to put them on the plate as kind of a nest, and then maybe you have a few scallops or a little piece of fish or some nice grain, and just put whatever it is, either hot or cold, on top of the little nest of greens. And sometimes just with one thing. I mean, it's really fun to think of it that way, as just a bottom layer on a couple of other pieces of food.
I'm curious when you're working with these very kind of, I mean, they sound very delicate, kind of precious almost, the edible flowers, the fine herbs. I mean, how does that shape, you know, your what equipment you use or how you're able to wash it or harvest it or issues of timing with regards to, you know, when it's picked versus when it's served? I mean, how does that present different challenges when you're working with these types of plants?
Well, a lot of things that you might think of as delicate really are pretty tough out there. I mean, in the sense of hardy and durable. The important thing is to get them chilled immediately, which we do in our, I mean, we take them right from the field into the walk-in refrigerator within minutes, and that's a big deal, and that they be dry instead of wet. Every now and then it's raining when we pick, and that's a big problem. We try to dry as best we can, but we warn the customers these may not last as long as you're used to having them last because they were wet, and then we deliver them refrigerated. I mean, the whole keeping them below 40 degrees, above 30, you know, in the sort of higher 30s or around in the summer, you know, you don't want basil below 40. So around 40 degrees is pretty ideal. But if you let them sit out too long on a hot day, they sometimes look great when you pack them, and then they start rotting. So, but we're getting better at knowing how to handle them for the best results. What was your question again? Tell me.
No, I was thinking about, you know, equipment and, I mean, you talked about timing, but as far as, like, harvesting, I just picture you out there with, like, little scissors, but, I mean,
yes, how we do it, with little scissors. And that's why, unfortunately, they have to cost as much as they do, because a human being is out there on his knees snipping.
And that's really the only way to, I mean, I'm asking, that is that really the only way to grow greens of this variety? I mean, are we ever going to see kind of a mechanized version, or we should just understand, like, part of the cost is that labor. I mean, that's a big chunk of what it takes to to create greens or herbs like this?
Well, there are machines that cut greens mechanically, and I think I've seen them in the Johnny's seed catalog, and I'm sure that the huge farms in California do those, and other people too, perhaps, large quantity, but we're such small scale that the cost of one of those would be a lot. Also, you have to have absolutely perfect precision leveled fields in order to do that. You can't have anything lumpy bumpy or out of the way.
Right. So what do you, I mean, what do you think it was about your farm that drew Dee Dee to you and, you know, created this kind of transformative year? And what did anything kind of happen throughout the course of the time that you've worked with her? Any particular stories you'd like to share that were big learning points for you or for her?
Well, it is a constant discovery with Dee Dee, as with many people who come out here, even who aren't chefs, people who just eat the things. It always amazes me, although it shouldn't, perhaps, because I'm so used to this tremendous variety that I've become acquainted with over many years of plants and parts of plants, that I forget that most people haven't a clue that these things even exist in the world. And so I think the thing that I remember being kind of amusing long-term with Dee Dee was she would just leave a pile of fresh-cut leaves of whatever it is just sitting on the counter, or she'd put it in the refrigerator without covering it. And all those things lead to wilting, and we're so super conscious of having this stuff have a long shelf life that we, that would just ring an alarm in my head.
Right, right.
What are you doing? I remember telling her over and over again, no, you have to wrap them, you have to cover them, you have to get them in the refrigerator, which means that there's less waste because they go farther. So that's part of that whole making things go as far as they can philosophy.
Go ahead. No, please.
I did listen to your interview with her, and when she was talking about teaching the kids, I had a very amusing thing with kids recently. We had a book signing, and we gave the leftover, we brought a lot of samples for people, and we gave them to the staff of the little store to take home, and one of the people who brought them home reported that her 4 and 6-year-olds just loved this big, powerfully flavored arugula. And I said, and pea greens, big kind of tougher stem pea greens. And I was amazed, and she said, yeah, they pretended they were dinosaurs. and they could let the things hang out of the corners of their mouths like the dinosaurs in the movies. Anyway, having stories like that and little and variations, and I know she is a lot of fun. I think I've learned to be aware of what kids like in her classes. I think that's been good. And then her combinations of things are just amazing. Like she'll put things together. I'm trying to think of examples. Almost all the recipes have taught me something new. Sunchokes. I grow sunchokes. They're these little things. They're in the ground. But I wouldn't have thought of making them to bisques and dumplings. Those are the two that I can think of, and which are wonderful.
Yeah. Well, we are almost out of time, but I did want to touch on one other story from the book that I thought was so curious. Your daughter saves bacon fat for you, and you spread it on logs in your house. Did I read that correctly?
That's my son. Yeah, because we always did that at home, and he's very fond of bacon, and so every Christmas he brings me his saved jars of the leftover fat, which you can. Yes, it's great for starting fires. You can just put it on the logs and or the kindling, and up it goes.
Oh, wow. Well, Ava, thank you so much for coming on the show today. The book is Wild Flavors by Dee Dee Emmons. It's one chef's transformative year cooking from Eva's Farm. Thank you so much, and look forward to having you on the show again and hearing more about your seasons in the years to come.
Thank you, Erin. It's been a pleasure.
listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.